for what's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Voters in South Korea are choosing a replacement to former President Park Geun-hye, who's caught up in a corruption scandal resulting in her impeachment and removal from office. Corruption, slowing economic growth, and relations with North Korea top voter concerns. Democratic Party of Korea frontrunner Moon Jae-in said he completed the campaign with every ounce of energy and felt a great desire among the people to build a country we can be proud of. The human rights lawyer has promised to tackle corruption, increase spending to create jobs, and wants more engagement with North Korea. Stephen Norper is senior director of the Korea Society and a Columbia University professor.
Moon Jae-in has talked about something like a Sunshine 2, meaning an opening akin to the individual whom he worked for, Roh Moo-hyun, and his predecessor, Kim Dae-jung, meaning the opening to North Korea, incentives in terms of economic incentives and trying to find a way to deal with the North that is more pro-engagement.
The winning candidate is expected to be sworn in Wednesday after results are made official. Nigeria Monday released the names of the 82 schoolgirls freed in negotiations with the militant group Boko Haram after 3 years' captivity. Meanwhile, Laura Boldrini, president of Italy's Chamber of Deputies, met Monday with members of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign in Abuja.
You played a major role in the liberation of the girls because you didn't give up every day for each day you were here to say, release our girls.
The girls abducted April 2014 were freed in exchange for several detained Boko Haram commanders. More than 100 kidnapped from the village of Chibok are still being held. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is set to meet his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Washington Wednesday to discuss global hotspots, including Ukraine and Syria. The meeting comes as Moscow pushes for creation of 4 so-called de-escalation zones, supported by Turkey and Iran, to help ease 6 years of conflict in Syria. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal is skeptical.
The creation of the de-escalation zones may lead to some pacification, but I don't see it having a definitive effect for the simple reason that people who are being affected are not being represented.
He said the opposition has not been involved. He also questions what role the U.S. would play. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says the U.S. will look at the proposal and see if it will work, especially if the plan as it relates to efforts to defeat the Islamic State. Monday, Syria's foreign minister said no foreign forces will be allowed to monitor the de-escalation agreement. And the U.N. announced a resumption of Geneva peace talks on Syria next week. White House spokesman Sean Spicer Monday was asked if the latest American detained in North Korea is aimed at stoking tensions with the U.S. over the North's banned nuclear and missile program.
Obviously, this is concerning. We're well aware of it, and we're going to work through the Embassy of Sweden that has a facility in North Korea, or an embassy in North Korea, through our State Department to seek the release of the individuals there, but I would refer you to the State Department on that.
Kim Hak-sun was on the staff of the private Pyongyang University of Science and Technology and was detained Saturday, accused of unspecified hostile acts. His wife has appealed for his release. His arrest brings to 4 the number of U.S. citizens being detained by Pyongyang. At least 6 people were killed Monday after a suicide bomber rammed a car laden with explosives into an Italian cafe in the capital Mogadishu Monday. An attack claimed by the insurgent group al-Shabaab, several others were wounded. More anti-government protests rocked Venezuela's cities Monday, and police responded with tear gas. Weeks of unrest over the country's worsening social and economic conditions has left nearly 40 dead. The opposition demands socialist President Nicolas Maduro leave office and new elections are held. Forces loyal to Libya's eastern administration Monday pushed into 2 districts of the embattled city Benghazi. Elements of the Libyan National Army have been fighting for control of the country's second-largest city for 3 years against jihadist militia. The Trump administration defended its temporary travel ban in federal court Monday for travelers from 6 mostly Muslim countries, acting Solicitor General Jeffrey Wall insisting it's not a Muslim ban. Both the original ban issued in January and a revised ban have been held up to legal challenge.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Somalia's minister accuses Al-Shabaab of cowardice for attacking innocent civilians.
This is proven to be the case that those terrorists have no agenda other than to kill innocent people just to get an attention from the media.
Abdi Rahman Omar Osman is Somalia's Minister of Information. South Sudan postpones the swearing-in of its much-awaited National Dialogue Steering Committee. Meanwhile, a retired South Sudanese clergy has called on President Salva Kiir to step down. And Liberian health authorities say meningitis is the probable cause of the mysterious illness that has killed 13 people so far.
With the results, we have from the CDC Atlanta, we think we are most likely dealing with a meningitis outbreak, meningitis serotype C.
Dr. Bernice Dan is Liberia's Minister of Health. The UN peacekeeping mission in Mali is focusing on women to help reduce community violence. And the Urban League says economic gains improve African-American lives. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Somalia's Minister of Information says the country's security forces are doing a fantastic job in going after the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Abdi Rahman Omar Osman says his government, with the support of its allies, is determined to wipe out terrorists not only from Somalia but throughout the world. This comes as at least 8 people, including a Somali general, were killed on Monday when a car bomb exploded near a cafe in the capital, Mogadishu. At least 10 others were injured. The explosion occurred as President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed was meeting with his national security team. Minister Osman said the terrorist group has chosen to attack defenseless innocent civilians because Somali security forces have done a good job in preventing them from attacking government institutions.
This is one of those days where the terrorist group exploded a car with full of explosive items in one of the cafes in downtown of Mogadishu that killed innocent people who were at the cafe or bypassers, and this is proven to be the case that those terrorists have no agenda other than to kill innocent people just to get an attention from the media.
Minister, tell me, who was this General Abdi Bashir Aden, who is among those that were killed? Who is he?
Well, I cannot specify, but all we know is that so far civilians were among the killed people. Investigations are undergoing at the moment. So this is a cafeteria where ordinary people sit. It wasn't a government institution, and it wasn't where senior officials normally gather. So this is a deliberate attempt to just disrupt the city and to make threats directly to the public.
Do you think, Mr. Minister, that the terrorist groups were targeting a particular individual, or this was just a random explosion?
It was one of those things that they continually bomb at a cafeteria where ordinary citizens gather, because the government is very strong in terms of protecting them to go to where the government institutions are. So therefore, since they cannot infiltrate the government institutions, their only option is to show to the world that they still can cause havoc to civilians.
The way we understand it, Mr. Minister, was that this explosion took place during the time that the president of Somalia was meeting with your National Security Council. What does this say about your National Security Council having advanced knowledge about something that might happen?
Well, this is those people who want to kill themselves, those suicide bombers, those that it's very difficult to really avoid those scenarios, because all they're doing is to kill innocent people. You can imagine that because of our security, and our security council are doing really fantastic job. They know that we have the plan for Mogadishu security plan. We have a military operation plan to go after Al-Shabaab.
Minister, I think it was on Friday last week that it was reported in the U.S. media that a U.S. Navy SEAL was killed in Somalia. What can you tell us?
Well, this is you reporting about the U.S. serviceman that was killed. At the same time, that was an attempt to really disrupt al-Shabaab for the heinous attack. And as a result of that, their leader was killed in that attack carried out by Somali forces with the support of our allies. We are here in one mission together, which is to wipe out terrorists in our soil. And this is a global solution that requires to eliminate the threat posed by terrorists who are not only causing the havoc and problems to Somalia, but to the world.
Abdi Rahman Omar Osman is Somalia's Minister of Information. He was speaking with me from the capital, Mogadishu. In South Sudan, the swearing-in of the steering committee for the much-talked-about national dialogue has been suspended indefinitely due to a lack of quorum. President Salva Kiir's spokesman says half of the committee members appointed by the president have yet to report to duty. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
President Kiir said in February the national dialogue would begin sometime in early March, but there is doubt over whether the long-awaited exercise will start at all. Last month, presidential spokesman Atteni Wek Atteni said financial and technical challenges prevented the swearing-in of the committee charged with steering the dialogue. Yesterday, Atteni announced the committee's swearing-in was suspended indefinitely.
It has been postponed until further notice because the percentage of the steering committee was only 20%. So we are waiting to collect the number of committee members, at least to be 50 plus before they are sworn in.
Civil society activist Rajab Mohandis says the government has been inconsistent in its effort to get the dialogue off the ground ever since Mr. Kiir announced the initiative. He says delays in commencing the dialogue weaken the initiative and make citizens lose hope in its ability to end the ongoing conflict. Mohandis, who heads the South Sudanese Network for Democracy and Elections, says the indefinite suspension of the swearing-in happened because the committee is too large.
We have been to the states, and people are telling us in the states that they are confused about the process of the national dialogue. Today, the president makes commitment that, yes, the national dialogue will be conducted and is moving to reconstitute the committee and swear in the members. You see, as he has been saying all this while. And then the following day, someone else comes and says, we don't have money for the national dialogue. Meaning whatever the president is saying will not happen because there is no money.
Mohandis says the government must have a clear channel of communication to build trust among the people that the dialogue will take place and make a difference. He says they have shown no practical steps to accompany their political statements on the process, including inflammatory statements such as calling other political parties terrorists. Mohandis says the government must first pare down the steering committee.
Putting together a robust committee that is sizable enough to run the process effectively will give people a sign of hope. Now, we only talk about forming the committee and we talk about the committee taking up the starting the process, but actually there are no steps happening to show citizens that these words are being translated into action.
The government needs to engage other parties and discuss ways to end the fighting across the country in order to give citizens hope, according to Mohandis. And he says including all warring parties to the country's conflict is the only way to make the dialogue genuine. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 9th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. A prominent retired South Sudanese Anglican clergy is calling on President Salva Kiir to step down. The Reverend Canon Clement Janda, who is also a member of the Council of States, was recently appointed by President Kiir to serve on the steering committee of the National Dialogue. Canon Janda issued a statement over the weekend declining to be a part of the committee, saying the process lacks credibility and is not inclusive enough to solve South Sudan's conflict.
The current process of national dialogue is not going to bring peace to South Sudan. this is why I withdrew. If I knew it was really a genuine process that people could dialogue in order to bring peace to South Sudan, I would not have withdrawn.
And why do you think the process will not bring peace?
What has happened is that the decree of the 25th is an enlarged monologue. It is not changed in substance. You see, John, for it to be a dialogue presupposes several sides to the issue. I have reason to believe that this is not going to be a dialogue because I was even told that in the next day or two, or maybe today, the group, the so-called dialogue, were being sworn in. How do you swear in a group that is going to discuss issues freely and you swear them to pay allegiance to what?
Reverend Clement Janda, you have a lot of experience. You worked with the All African Conference of Churches for many, many years, and that organization has been credited for resolving a lot of conflict around Africa. Now you're pulling out from a process that is supposed to bring peace to your country, and you're citing that the process is not transparent. What else is there left for your country to achieve peace?
Only and only if the leadership of the country begins to listen to people who talk constructively. Only when they are ready to sit together with those they disagree, then can we begin to see light at the end of the tunnel.
Reverend Janda, if you are given an opportunity to speak to President Kiir today, what would you tell him?
I would tell him, my brother, in the name of the country and in the name of Jesus Christ, for whom you and I claim to be followers, just step aside and let somebody lead the country for an interim period of 30 months. Then you, Salva Kiir, or another person, including Machar, if you people really believe that you are still popular, wait until elections and let the country choose for itself a leadership. If that leader becomes Salva Kiir by election, I will say hallelujah. If that becomes Machar by election, I will say hallelujah. If it becomes any other person, I would say hallelujah, so long as people will have been elected by a credible process.
That was the Reverend Canon Clement Janda, a member of South Sudan's Council of State. He was speaking to VOA's John Tanza from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Liberian health authorities say meningitis is the probable cause of the mysterious illness that has killed 13 people so far. Liberia's Minister of Health, Dr. Bernice Dan, says a total of 31 cases have been linked to a funeral that took place late April this year in Liberia's southeastern Sino County. The authorities have already ruled out Ebola as the cause of the deaths. Dr. Dan says out of 7 specimens that were tested by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, on 4 dead patients, 4 came out positive for meningitis.
As of May 7, we have had a total of 31 cases, including 13 deaths reported from 3 counties. So the 13 deaths, 10 came from Sino, 2 from Montserrado, and 1 from Bassa. All of the cases were actually linked to a funeral activity that was held in Sino. 2 cases remain in the hospital, and they are much stable up to yesterday. One was in FGA Grant, and the second one was in Grand Bassett County. We've continued with contact tracing. So to date, we have a total number of 110 attendees, people who attended the funeral, and they came from 6 counties, Sino, Montserrado, Maryland, Grand Gida, Grand Coup, and Grand Bassett. We've also line-listed about 207 cases. They are contacts from those who attended from Sino, Montserrado, and Grand Bassett.
When I spoke to your chief medical officer, your department has ruled out Ebola as the cause of these deaths. What have you found out in terms of the cost of the deaths?
We've done some laboratory investigations to confirm our thoughts. We already ruled out Ebola and Lassa fever. We sent some specimens through MSF to France, and they ruled out also Ebola, Marburg, Lassa fever, Congo hemorrhagic viruses. out of 7 specimens that were tested in CDC Atlanta on 4 patients who are all deceased, all 4 of those specimens tested positive. We also have a pathologist in country over the weekend, and he did autopsy, and the results are pending. His findings are indeterminate, and so we will continue with laboratory investigations. We'll do toxicology, microbiology, histopathology, and molecular testing. Now, with the results we have from the CDC Atlanta, we think we are most likely dealing with a meningitis outbreak, meningitis serotype C. And so from the initial stages, we put in public health measures. And so we are continuing with that.
These people who attended the funeral must have eaten some food there or drank some water or some liquid. I mean, what would you say is the cause of meningitis that could or may have been associated with the source of this infection?
Normally, with bacterial meningitis, we can have natural carriers, about 10 to 20% in the population. Because they are normal carriers, they do not come down with the disease, but they can infect other people through sputum and saliva, so coughing and sneezing. You will have an outbreak where you have people gather together. So that can link to the idea that people went to funeral, they were at the wake, the funeral, the repast. So that is one reason why we think the lab results should be taken seriously. Another thing there too are the signs and symptoms that we saw. They were not typical of meningitis, but there were some of the signs and symptoms that also we do see in meningitis cases: headache, weakness, mental confusion. Unfortunately, none of these patients complain about fever, which is a normal thing we see in bacterial meningitis. None of them complain about neck stiffness. Maybe they were too sick because most of the initial cases also died on arrival at the hospital. So with the signs and symptoms that we have, coupled with the initial laboratory testing, we think that is why we are calling it probable meningitis outbreak. We will continue to test. We have asked MSF to confirm the meningitis in there on a laboratory in France, and we'll continue to test. We are not ruling out anything at this moment until we have done all the tests and we are satisfied.
So, Madam Minister, you said that some of the specimens tested positive. Were you talking about they tested positive for meningitis?
Yes. I said 7 specimens from 4 patients. All the patients were deceased. The test was done in CDC Atlanta, and all 4 of those patients tested positive of meningitis.
Minister, so can the people conclude that so far the cause of these deaths could be meningitis?
Yes, that's why we are saying probable. The cause of the death could be meningitis.
Dr. Bernice Dan is Liberia's Minister of Health. She was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The United Nations peacekeeping mission in Mali is focusing on women in the Timbuktu region to help reduce community violence. The mission hopes that empowering these women through economic generating projects will lead to a more stable peace in a region that has seen fighting since 2012. Samba Tall, Director of Security Sector Reform, as well as Disarmament, Demobilization and Economic Reinsertion for the mission, also known as MINUSMA, talked about the projects in Timbuktu and the current security situation there.
In fact, MINUSMA consults with Association of Women, try to identify what are the conflict drivers in the area, what are the shortages, and initiate with them socio-economic projects. It can go from gardening, dyeing, agriculture, or cattle raising, from the beginning to the end. Like what was done last time in Timbuktu is a perimeter of 4 hectares that was fenced. Addiction of water was provided. Tank waters were installed with solar panels. Seeds were provided, and the women started to work. And there is a small unit for transformation of the product in order to put it in the market. This gives the women a kind of income which they share in common. The objective is first to recognize them and second to empower them economically.
How can empowering women economically reduce community violence?
Because, you know, in fact, most of the local conflicts are around resources. either it's scarcity of land, it's scarcity of water, or you have the cattle of the herders destroying the crops of the sedentary people. All the projects are economically driven, but we try to see what is the resource at stake, and we try either to better help it or to augment the resource that you use the conflict.
What is the current security situation in the Timbuktu region?
Timbuktu region was one of the regions affected by the conflict in North Mali. And also it's a very dry region. So you have scarcity of resources. And you have local populations composed of herders and sedentary people. So all this, in fact, have to be managed in a way where each community can live according to its traditional way of living. Implementation of the peace agreement is in a good pace. It is being implemented well, at a slow pace, but it is being well implemented. Unfortunately, we have these terrorist groups that are allied to Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb or so, who are trying to derail the peace process. They are not very numerous. They don't have many men, but they really target sometimes state authorities, they target the Malian armed forces, and even international NGOs.
That was Samba Tall, Director of Security Sector Reform, Disarmament, Demobilization, and Economic Reinsertion for MINUSMA. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Mali's capital, Bamako. A leading civil rights organization says African Americans and Hispanics have made positive strides economically and educationally during the past year. But viewers Chris Simpkins reports the National Urban League finds minority groups lag behind their white counterparts in other measurements of racial equality.
The theme of this year's State of Black America report is Protect Our Progress.
National Urban League CEO Mark Morial says blacks and Hispanics, the nation's largest racial minorities, are better off economically than a year ago.
The jobless numbers have come down and more black people and more people overall are working today than in almost 10 years.
But the State of Black America report suggests African Americans and Hispanics still lag behind whites economically. The annual study found the standard of living for African Americans is 72.3% of that of the average white person. For Hispanics, the equality index is 78.4%. Despite some progress, Morial is worried about wage growth.
Even though people are working, they're economically in pain because their paychecks don't go as far today as they went 10 years ago.
The index measures quality of life for blacks and Hispanics in terms of economies, health, education, social justice, and civic engagement. According to the report, racial disparities plague minorities when it comes to social justice equality, noting that more blacks are jailed than whites after being arrested.
That's viewers Chris Simpkins reporting, and that's it for this Tuesday, May 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer David Vandy, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is the voice of America's Sonny Young. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the Sunny Side of Sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 17:30 UTC, right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.